We really try to understand submarkets really well. So when we go look at an asset, we've just built a database of all the deals that we've looked at, and we figured out what are the things that we feel cause good deals to be good deals and other deals to be bad deals.
Welcome to Passive Income Unlocked, where we unlock the doors to intelligent, hands-off real estate investing. We talk to experts in the space about what they do, how they do it, and most importantly, why they do it. My passion is careful, intelligent investing and closing the investing gap one investor at a time. While money doesn't buy happiness, passive income does have the potential to buy back your time. What would you choose to do with your time if you had enough passive income to live your best life? How would you like to spend your days? What kind of impact would you like to make? I'm here to tell you, dream big. There's no ceiling. It's all possible if you take consistent action towards your goals. It's been said that success is 80% mindset and 20% strategy. So we discuss both. Ready to gain knowledge and take action? Let's dive in.
Hey everyone, and welcome back to the show. Today, I am so excited to announce and introduce our guest for the day, Ryan Nunes. Ryan, thank you so much for being here.
Suja, thanks for having me.
Awesome. Well, I'm really excited for you to share your background and experience with the listeners, how you got started in real estate and what you're up to now and the world that you came from. I know you're going to have a ton of valuable insights for folks. So why don't you start us off by just giving us a bit of a general background into yourself and how you got into real estate and what you're doing now.
Sure. So I grew up on the East Coast, went to Georgetown for my undergrad, did my MBA at NYU. So I was working in finance, the logical progression of being on the East Coast, working in finance, and was to go work on Wall Street and had an opportunity to do that. Commodities markets were really booming, similar to the tech revolution. Commodities went through their own revolution called the shale revolution. It was just in the beginning stages of that. Just had a career on Wall Street that really took off, in the right place at the right time, having some great clients and just being very client-oriented as well as solution-oriented. And that went quite well.
Just real quick, did you say the shale revolution?
Shale revolution. So
shale, okay, got it.
So the Permian Basin, maybe some folks have heard of and so forth. And then had a really good run at the banks, did that for 13 years. And the past, I would say 4 or 5 years, was just seeing how, particularly post-financial crisis, there was a lot of restrictions put on banks. And the kind of thesis there or the strategy was to do more with less. And so that commodities, very cyclical. So you had some great times, you had some horrible times. And so the past 5 years or so, I'd been thinking about what does life look like after commodities, and had explored a number of different things, looking at starting a childhood early development school to music program to opening some restaurants. And, I decided that those things weren't just the best fit for me. But I did come across someone at a Chuck E. Cheese birthday party, and it was a friend of my son's, and his father was there talking about how he just transitioned to multifamily. And I was like, wow, this is really interesting. And really saw that this is what I'd been looking for before. It was something that had a lot of longevity and sustainability to it. And I was looking for things I could apprentice my children with and that would generate passive income and really could just, build a whole new career and learn something new. So, effectively fast forward, and sought out some folks that were experienced and general partners so that I could join them on two deals that they were in the process of working on. And I just said, hey, I just want to get my hands dirty. I want to learn the business. And, basically a few weeks into those calls on the asset management side and operations, realized like, hey, I've run businesses before on Wall Street. And that was, just a very rigorous, high level approach. And I said, hey, this is something very transferable to apartments and multifamily. And so decided at that point, I was going to partner with someone that had a similar Wall Street background as myself, and similar vision and goals and discipline and work ethic. And so we kind of grew organically, building out our quote unquote team of who we're going to use in different markets for property management, who we were going to use for financing and insurance and so forth. And fast forward a little bit of time, and we ended up closing our third deal that we led just a month ago. So it's been a great run. And through that process, got a over $224,000 refund from the IRS through investing in apartments, redeployed that into the three deals that we led. And so it's just been great to see our deals perform well, to see investors become repeat investors because they like the data-driven, very deep analytical approach and just the transparency that we provide.
Awesome. Sounds like you've done a really great job building a foundation for your investment, I mean, for your real estate syndication business. And I just love to, I mean, there's so much there. Thank you for sharing that background. You know, a lot of us take a little bit of a windy path towards finding real estate. Then when it fits, it fits. So I'm curious if you would go into the sort of data-driven, detailed analytical approach and like what you think it you've done maybe differently than other people that has really created this like repeat investor experience.
Yeah, so a few things there. You know, on the data-driven side, and we really try to understand submarkets really well. So when we go look at an asset, you know, we've just built a database of all the deals that we've looked at, and we figured out what are the things that we feel cause good deals to be good deals and other deals to be bad deals. And what are the things that we can point to when we're looking at an opportunity and say, hey, this is something interesting. We're going to jump on it. So, you know, we'll look at median incomes. We'll look at other demographic data. We'll look at, you know, just analyze the T12. So we've built our own proprietary tools to really rip apart a financial statement of an apartment to really see, you know, where the sensitivities are, you know, where have either recurring CapEx issues been, where have recurring plumbing issues been, and so forth, and just really trying to understand and get our arms around the financials very quickly through a number of tools that we built, as well as the rent roll. So another, and that just lists here are all the people that live at the apartment, when they moved in, how long the leases are. And we try to assess that and almost put a scoring on it to say, you know, what is the health of this rent roll? For instance, the first deal that we bought, we saw that people were living there for 4 years. And the submarket, if you looked at rent comps on face value, you're like, wow, it doesn't look very attractive from a rent comp perspective. But when you start digging deeper, you have to say, why are people living there 4 years? And you look at the characteristics of the building and it being single story. And that's very, very unique. It's irreplaceable because no one's going to build single story apartments anymore. It just doesn't make sense. It takes a lot of land and so forth. And they're going to stack them as high as they can. So in as little land as possible. And so when we start looking at those things, just a very data-driven approach, and we started to see that, wow, this thing is going to really perform well because people want to live there. So if we push rents, you know, people are going to stay. And that's what ended up happening. So we've pushed rents. We took over that property in October 14th of 2020. Effective rents at that time were $807. We bumped them to $930 for classic, $1,000 for premium. We got both of those. And then we recently took the $930 up to $1,000 and we leased a unit $1,000 for a classic. And then not only that, people were renewing at those premium rents without us even having to touch the units, just because they wanted to stay at that property. It was great location, path of progress. So it's just a combination of all those things where we look at crime, we look at schools, and we just try to understand how the areas are trending. And, you know, and on top of that, yes, it is very data-driven, but there's also an element of, you know, when I toured that asset and I toured the other two assets that we purchased, it was like, this just feels really good. Yeah, the numbers are one thing. We're very analytical. Another thing is the asset feels good and we like it. So let's buy it. On your second question of investors and stickiness there, it's just, you know, we just over-communicate. I've come from, you know, Wall Street where it's like the difference between, you know, I would say one word, you know, could either make or lose you millions of dollars. For instance, we would say done when a trade is done, and done away means, hey, we lost a trade, somebody else did it. And so those difference of just that one word could cost a lot of money and potentially cost a career. So that is just ingrained in me. So I carry that on to communication with investors, being very upfront, transparent, honest. And, you know, basically like to say that we have Wall Street and analytics with Eagle Scout ethics. And that is, you know, how we carry ourselves, just very professionally. And we take a very professional institutional approach to a very inefficient, non-institutional part of the asset class. And I think just that communication, the deal performance, and just being on top of things, over-communicating in our monthly reports, them being timely, our K-1s being on time, you know, a culmination of all those things. I was out last night and an investor who invested in two of our three deals. he said, you know, anytime I reach out to you, like I get a response immediately. And that's just because, you know, I worked in a commodities market where, and by definition, it's commoditized because it is, you're selling a commoditized commodity. And effectively, if you didn't respond to a client within seconds, you know, it was just like the trade got done away. So I just take that same approach with investors. And to me, it's important. They've entrusted me with their money and I feel very responsible for that and feel that when they reach out with a question, they get a response. And, you know, I know because I've invested in 16, you know, deals passively that that's not always the case. You reach out to sponsors and, you know, either they don't care or they don't want to answer tough questions or whatever it is, or they're too busy. But, you know, for whatever deal, it's just, to me, it's important. I mean, if we didn't have investors, we wouldn't have deals.
For sure. Yeah. I think that makes so much sense. Everything that you just laid out there. I'm curious about these tools that you've made to kind of take this data-driven approach. Can you just describe the tools that you've made?
Yeah, I mean, we've just built some analytical tools where they'll highlight kind of the abnormalities in T12s and or rent rolls and, you know, just consolidate and summarize information so we can get our arms around it quicker.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. And so then do you do like data inputs yourself or do you have somebody do that for you?
You know, we spend a lot of time building tools that help us get through data, you know, basically try to cut things off on, are we going to put it in two piles? Like, do we want to spend more time on it or do we want to move forward or sorry, pass on the deal? And so when we spend more time on it, then, you know, you have to put in the time to really understand it, but we do it all ourselves.
Okay. Yeah. I think that makes sense to have like an initial, you know, separation, what we're going to focus on and then move on from there.
Exactly.
Yeah. So I'm curious if you could just walk through your first deal. I mean, it's always helpful, I think, to hear people's stories of how they got started and would love to hear yours.
Yeah, sure. So, you know, on the two deals I co-sponsored, that just helped me get my feet wet, you know, understand a little bit of the process. And for sure on the operations side, because I came in more in the tail end of those deals, is understand that and how to run assets. And I really said, you know what, I'm working with guys that have 5 years of multifamily experience each, but I feel that how I run businesses on Wall Street, that's really the approach. That's just how I run and manage businesses. So I felt very confident and comfortable with that. It's just a process and apply that process and discipline and approach and out will come success. So on the finding the first deal, we had been visiting with a number of brokers. We had decided that we wanted to stay in the Texas Triangle. And, you know, there was an opportunity to look at a deal in San Antonio. And I drove out that day. I took a friend of mine, who's also a commodities guy in multifamily. And I just really liked the deal. I mean, the numbers, you know, all made sense. And then when I saw the deal, I remember texting my business partners like, we got to buy this. We bid on it. And unfortunately, we did not win it at that time. And that was November 2019. And about 6 months later, you know, so COVID happened and I was visiting with the broker and I just said, whatever happened to that deal? And he said, you know what? It just fell out of contract like yesterday. And I said, what? It didn't close after 6 months? And I said, you know, we're going to close it in 60 days. And once we signed the contract and, you know, he basically vouched to that seller who was getting really frustrated from an experienced, you know, actually a guy that wrote a book on multifamily sponsor. And, you know, here we were with our first, you know, deal as leads and the broker is saying, hey, you know, these guys are going to close it. You know, I really believe in them and they know what they're doing. They know what they're talking about. And, you know, with that recommendation, he awarded us the deal and we closed it in 60 days. And what was really interesting is we were, you know, concerned. I mean, San Antonio, it's kind of I'd say it's more like at that time for us, it was just new of people that invested in deals in San Antonio and they didn't perform very well. And so we were pretty humble about the raise and we were like, man, you know, like at that time I said, hey, I'll buy something, but I never know how the raise will go. So I want to be able to salvage it by just like buying it myself if the raise completely went sideways. And, you know, we were really humbled. We raised, it was a small raise, it was $2 million for that first deal, but we raised that in a few hours. I think it took like 2 hours and the thing was done. And so we ended up cutting everybody back. And, you know, people have just had a great experience from that time. They invested in the second and third deals, invested more. So we decided strategically to let as many people in on that first deal just so that they could experience working with us, because we felt like that we found a really good deal and mm-hmm. we knew it was going to perform. And, you know, we were really just trying to groom people for hopefully investing and telling their friends, which they did, and, you know, coworkers and colleagues and, you know, parents and so forth. And so that helped us fund the next two deals later on. So, which were raises that were more than two times that size.
For sure. Yeah, I think that makes so much sense, is the more people that you can kind of bring into your fold earlier and get that experience, you know, the over communication that you guys do, and what if maybe there's some returns that they're experiencing, and just like, it's once that starts to happen, the more people that can experience it, the more referrals are going to come in, and the more you can kind of grow quickly. So that makes a lot of sense to have taken that approach. You know, you mentioned a couple times, and you've talked about this, you touched on this, but I kind of want to sort of see if we can do a little bit of a deeper dive into what you think sets you apart from, you know, with your Wall Street, running businesses on Wall Street experience. How are you able to, I mean, I know we've talked about like the data-driven approach, but can you just expand on that a little bit more? I kind of want to dive into that.
This show is sponsored by Lux Capital Investment Group. Lux Capital provides pre-vetted, highly favorable investment opportunities on a risk-adjusted basis. Our opportunities are diversified across asset classes, geographies, and operators. We are nothing short of rigorous in our approach to evaluating investments. We focus on downside protection, conservative underwriting, recession-resistant asset classes, and forging strong relationships with operating partners and investors. If you want to be an intelligent, hands-off investor and gain access to the types of deals that I like to invest in personally, make sure to go to lux-cap.com, L-U-X-E-C-A-P.com, and sign up for our newsletter.
Yeah, on the Wall Street side, you know, coming from a super, I guess, disciplined background where it's like, you know, someone, a broker shows us something and within 24 hours, you know, we're going to respond one way or the other. We're going to give them feedback. And, you know, we feel like doing that provides just an element of, wow, these guys really care and they know what they're doing. And, you know, we're not going to waste anybody's time. So, you know, I'd say that's one element. You know, on the investor side, I shared some color on that, just being very upfront, you know, being full disclosure on our decks. I mean, some of them are, gosh, 50 pages or so slide decks. I mean, but, you know, all very comprehensive. Here's expenses line by line. Here is how the T12 is versus, you know, our pro forma. So people can see like, how are you taking from where it is today to the future? And just really detailing what is going through other income, what's happening on the financing side. You know, just that level of disclosure, I think, is just puts people at ease. You know, and it's a lot of, for me, it's when I've invested with people, you just get an icky feeling. You just, you know, don't walk, run, and it's kind of been my approach. And we just want people to feel real comfortable that, you know, there's nothing to hide. You know, for instance, there was a deal that we saw, you know, today, presentation, I said, Shay, and they showed no underwriting at all. There was no support. And then we found the underwriting. It was like, wow, this is crazy. There's a reason they don't want to share it, because, you know, it's way more aggressive than anything that, you know, someone could have imagined. And if someone saw that, they probably wouldn't want to invest in the deal. So, you know, we feel like the question of what are you not telling me? We just want to lay everything out and people feel like, hey, I can't promise our deals are always going to perform well, but what I can promise you is that we're going to work really hard and we're going to be transparent. I mean, I think people forgive you when you say you're sorry or you say, hey, this went wrong, we're trying to fix it, because we are. I mean, multifamily, and I was kind of saying to somebody else, it's like you have 150 units, you have 150 different families or people's problems at a property that you're trying to manage and make them peacefully coexist. But, you know, sometimes things go sideways, but you have to, you know, be able to be, you know, on your toes and react and, you know, be thoughtful and, you know, just lead with strength. So, you know, all those things that we just learned on Wall Street of, you know, being through really difficult situations and under pressure and, you know, performing and thinking on our feet and not delaying, just making quick decisions, whether it's staff compensation or whether seeing, you know, something where we feel just intuition of, hey, something's a little bit different with the asset right now. Like we need to, you know, go visit or, you know, step in or have another call or, you know, ask some follow-up questions, all those things that I feel we built from our professional career that we apply to these assets. And, I think we, you had mentioned about the first deal. So that we told investors we were going to distribute 6 months. That was the plan. We hope to put out our first distribution in after 6 months. We distributed after 4 months at 5% and then doubled to 10% in 6 months. And so we've been distributing that monthly to investors. And that's also something when you distribute monthly, it just takes more discipline because you really have to understand the business and what cash flows are going to look like. And I'm in a lot of deals, 95% of them are quarterly and it's just like, you never know what you're going to get, but monthly, we just feel like people remember it. And they're like, wow, thanks. And even if it's small, they'd rather have that visibility versus quarterly. They don't know what's going to come or if anything at all. So I think all those things were just, that's more of a professional institutional level where it's, monthly distributions as well.
For sure. Yeah, I think that there's so much to be said for that monthly distribution. If you're able to distribute monthly, then investors are hearing from you, receiving something monthly. And builds that trust a lot faster, I think. And yeah, it's less of a kind of waiting game, So I'm a big fan of that as well. So what would you say some of the larger or, a hurdle or a challenge that you've hit has been?
I'd say, a few things. One, there's a lot of deals out there. Finding a deal is easy. Finding a good deal is really, really hard. And I think we constantly have to recalibrate to the market. And it's tough, debt terms are changing as well as rent growth and cap rates. And so, just trying to stay on your toes, I think that's been challenging. And, at the end of the day, it's not a fair business. If someone has done more deals or knows the broker for longer or better, and, they're able to win deals. So those are, two large hurdles that I see that mm-hmm. get frustrating. We just try to keep our cool and try to do the right things and just, every at bat that we have and just try to perform in one way or the other, whether it's a small interaction and we just have a good name where people say, yeah, those guys are really solid. And yeah, you should sell them a deal. They're going to perform.
Yeah.
And so, all our deals we've closed on time and no retrade. So just did what we said we were going to do.
For sure. Yeah. And how did you make that relationship with your first broker of that first deal?
We looked at a number of deals with him. He was like, man, it's going to be hard to sell you guys a deal because you ask, a lot of questions and you dig so deep and, kind of uncovering things that they haven't yet uncovered. But, he knew that we spent the time where other people are like, just throwing in offers. It was like, these guys ask so many questions. They really understand the asset. So the probability of a retrade or probability that doesn't close is a lot smaller because they understand the deal. And so when he saw that, just the interactions mm-hmm. through, looking at his team's deals, it just, we built a relationship. And when it came time to award the deal, he's like, yeah, I know those guys. They're going to close.
Yeah, for sure. So when you raised that first, I think you said it was $2 million that filled up in a couple hours. How had you cultivated your investor base up until that point?
There was a number of folks, two camps. I would say people that knew me professionally that were like, wow, that's really interesting. I like the story. It's kind of a hedge against commodities in a way. Commodities are very volatile. Oil went from, 120 to minus 37, or I guess 80 before COVID. But to folks that look at multifamily and see the high occupancy, typically we're buying stabilized deals, so 90%+ occupied. And so, people understand that business and they see it as a form of passive income versus, volatile commodities careers. And so they like that. So there's investor base from there. And then other folks that I would say, in our first deal, we actually had, one of the top brokers in Houston invest, a guy that leads multifamily financing for an office here in Houston. So just large professionals invest with us, coaches for multifamily programs. We had three coaches invest with us. I mean, they just saw, the level of detail and, that we had put into the presentation, just the questions that we'd ask, the one broker that invests, the questions that we ask on his deals, he was like, man, same thing. I don't know if I'll ever sell you a deal, but, you ask a lot of questions and, if you ever find a deal, I want to invest in it because you guys know what you're doing.
Yeah.
So, I would say it's kind of those two camps and, that's where we've built relationships and those are the relationships we want, people that respect us for the hard work. And it's not, we're not so social media crazy and, kind of hollow words, but, really try to back up what we say.
For sure. That makes a lot of sense. And so if you are so, kind of strict with your due diligence and analysis, how do you get competitive? Like, if, I mean, are you, do you find that you're able to offer like a competitive price according to what other people are offering? How does that go?
Yeah. I mean, you know, just, we've probably been on 30, 40 deals and won 3. So, you know, for every deal that we win, we lose 9. So, you know, that's tough. And, you know, unfortunately, that's kind of the numbers. We looked at 300, been on 30 to 40, won 3. You know, it's kind of the numbers of this business. But it's recalibrating. You know, the rent growth that we're using now and the cap rates that we're using now is very different than a year ago or even 6 months ago. So the market has changed. And, you know, with inflation, potential inflation, and with, you know, the rent growth that we're seeing and so forth, we just recalibrate and say, do we believe it for this particular asset and submarket, or do we feel, you know, that that could change, you know, quickly? So
are you increasing your rent growth assumptions like across the board, or just, or how would you characterize?
Yeah, I would say, you know, a lot of that came through, you know, we just closed a deal a month ago. And so we've had 6 new leases. They were at an 18% increase. We've had 9 renewals, and those have been at an 8% increase. And so, you know, if we're putting in, we're going to grow lease, you know, grow new rents at 15 or new leases at 15%. It's like, I could see that happening. I could see even 20% happening because we've done it. Mm-hmm. You know, some of our assets, we've increased rents 30, 40%. So, you know, that has come with time. Like, but if you asked me 2 years ago, are you comfortable taking rents up, you know, 20%? I'd be like, I don't know. That seems really aggressive. But, you know, through that experience and through, you know, what are the upgrades in that submarket that will sell, and what do we need to do to attract the right type of resident, and, you know, how do we retain them and so forth? So, you know, all of those things has gotten us more comfortable with rent growth. But we also try to make sure that it's grounded in something. Like, do we see other comps doing it? Do we see, you know, the submarket or that asset performing historically, that it shows that it has the potential for that?
Yeah, for sure. So would you say that with the rent growth, I mean, I'm guess I'm wondering with COVID, like, is it just more people need housing? We have a shortage. Like, you know, at first, obviously, like, rents in, you know, the larger cities are going down. So maybe where are you, and why do you think the rent is growing in those places?
Yeah, I mean, so we focus on the Texas Triangle. And I think, you know, the simple story is that you have population growth that's pretty heavy. And I think COVID accelerated a lot of that. You have job growth. And then also, if you look at rents, I was just texting my business partners, you look at rents year over year, they're going to look really wonky, right? Because, you know, rents were softer during COVID. And then all of a sudden, you have the economy reopening, which, you know, is really been overwhelming in the sense that I didn't think things would reopen at the pace that they're reopening now. It's just gone crazy. And so, of course, you're going to see rent growth. But yeah, it's been higher than you would normally see. But then you have to say, what does that look like normalized? Is it going to be at that level? And I would say no, but it's going to be, could be higher. One, because you have wage inflation, you have price inflation and so forth. And I think this administration also lends itself to, you know, if you have, particularly for the demographic that we're targeting, or, you know, the B and C class space, is, you know, potentially you may have, you know, you're having places increase wages. So people realize that costs are going up, so they have to spend more on rent. So kind of riding that wave in a way. I mean, I think real estate assets, you know, with property taxes and insurance and other expenses, you know, just the same plumbing guy for sure, after the freeze, is not charging the same rates as he was before the freeze. So, I mean, all of those things you have to factor in, and, you know, to make the same cash on cash returns or total return, you have to increase rents. And so, yeah, I think that's happening now. And I think that, you know, it's going to, you know, it's like once Chipotle increases the price of their burrito, I doubt they're going to decrease it, right? It's just, it's kind of, once you're there, you don't, you know, you're not going to drop it.
Yeah, for sure. Totally. Cool. Well, thank you so much for sharing so much valuable, you know, information and experience. Is there anything that else that, you know, we didn't touch on that you want to share before we start to wrap up?
No, I think just for folks on, you know, that are interested in passive investments, I've created 25 questions that every passive investor should ask, just from my 13 years working on Wall Street and digging through so many deals. That's free on my website. It's lifechangingcapital.com. Just got a lot of great feedback on that. And, you know, I think before you invest, or maybe if you're thinking about it, or maybe you've invested with other folks, I would just love your feedback on that. Be helpful.
Yeah, for sure. Well, I hope everyone, you go and check out Ryan's question checklist and check out his website and get in touch if you have anything that you want to talk about. Thanks so much, Ryan, for coming on the show. Really appreciate everything that you shared, and look forward to seeing you next time.
Thanks, Suja. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much for listening to Passive Income Unlocked. Before you go on to continue with your amazing day, please take a moment to reflect on what you truly desire in life. Then think about one thing you can do to push the ball forward in that direction. Also, please head over to iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts and leave an honest rating and review of this show. It really would mean so much to me. Passive Income Unlocked is brought to you by Lux Capital. Lux works with investors nationwide to invest in real estate. We are closing the investing gap one investor at a time. Connect online at www.lux-cap.com, LUXE-CAP.com, for tons of free educational content to further your success.